Welcome to the Wizards of Ecom, where we talk about all things private label. My name is Carlos Alvarez, and I will be your host for the show. On today's episode, we have Nick Katz, somebody I have been seeing around social media for a while, and I guess Nick and I were Clubhouse friends, making it official here. Nick, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Carlos. Thank you very much for having me. It's great to be on.
Absolutely. Honor is mine. I want to set the stage here a little bit for people listening. We're not streaming this live, but we're doing this on Zoom. Since you are in, where in Japan are you at?
I am about halfway between Tokyo and Osaka, closest to Nagoya, kind of the middle bit.
I am in Miami, so we are a long way away from each other, but this is possible on Zoom. We're looking at each other. And you do not look Japanese at all. So I want to start there. You're in Japan. How long have you been in Japan?
Okay, so I've been in Japan since 1995. So a long time, about half my life. I'm from the UK. I'm from London, the outskirts of London. So say I came here when I was about 21, 22, and I never went back. I came out for 1 year, Carlos. Came out for 1 year. Got to be careful. And you get stuck. Well, not stuck. I love it here. Absolutely love it here. So I've got a family here. And yeah, been here for 25 years.
I've heard of this happening with like Bali. I've heard of it happening with like some of these other exotic places. I've heard of people like visiting Miami and staying. I've not heard Japan because, I mean, did you study Japanese or Asian anything? College.
I didn't study Japanese. I didn't even really know about Japan. It was a choice between Hong Kong and Japan. So this is 1995. So this is before the handover. I'm from the UK. So it was very easy to go to Hong Kong. You could go there for 1 year, work in a bar, have fun. I was young, and that was the plan. And then somebody told me about Japan. You could come out to Japan and teach for the Japanese government. They paid for your flights. They paid a really good salary at the time. It was like $3,000 a month. You know, this is a good salary when you're 21. Everything was paid for. Everything was organized. They arranged your accommodation. So I decided to do that. So I came out for 1 year. And then I liked it. Stayed for another year and then another year. And then it slowly just becomes the place that you are. And then you go back to the UK and you feel like you're going on holiday, you know? You go back home and you feel like you're going on holiday. And you come back to Japan, it's like, I'm back at home. So I didn't study. No, it was a spur-of-the-moment decision. It was always going to be Hong Kong. And I just went for Japan last minute, came out and loved it.
I'm going to ask you the thing that you probably like. People from another country never want to be asked, but I just have to do it. Like, I put you on the spot here, really set your credentials that you're Japanese. And that is, can you say subscribe to the Wizards of Ecom podcast in Japanese?
Wizards of Ecom, no, podcast.
I love it. I love it. That was hard. It has to be hard.
Because that. You have to put a katakana. Okay, this is the tip for anybody coming to Japan. So Japanese has got three languages, right? But one of them is the katakana alphabet. You basically, so there isn't a word for Wizards of Amazon. It's not like China where they would actually write that in Chinese. There'll be kanji that they will associate with that. So if it's like McDonald's, they'll use kanji in China, right? In Japan, they'll use this katakana. So it's makodonarudo. So Wizards of Amazon would be Wizard of Amazon. That's how you'd say it, right? But if you ever come to Japan and you get a taxi and you want the guy to go left, you could say hidari, which is left in Japanese, or you could go left dot and he'd understand you. You could go right dot and he'd understand you. You could stop.
it's almost like a form of pig Latin. Do you remember pig Latin?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's swapping like the A for an O.
Yeah. Kids, girls at school used to do that all the time when I was a kid. But yeah. But you could speak, you could say everything to somebody and make it sound like it's Japanese. And 9 times out of 10, you could probably make yourself understood. But anyway, yeah.
Everyone's probably thinking, okay, let me get my Rosetta Stone now. We actually had we're talking about kanji and the two others, which I'm going to mangle, but we had Riju Jawa from PPC Ninja do a presentation to our meetup group, and she broke down all three of them. It was a really interactive presentation. I thought it was cool, and then she'd like write out some stuff and be like, we had to identify which, I guess, dialect, is that it? Or which dialect they were. It's pretty cool.
Oh, which of the alphabets, I guess.
Yes, which of the alphabets, that's better.
Yeah, there are three. Yeah.
So today's episode, we're going to talk about maybe the best tool to use for product research in Japan. But before we do so, personal reasons, and I feel a story here. I just want to know your background on this. I want my listeners to know you better. Tell me when you sort of knew that e-commerce was what you were going to be doing.
Okay. So going back, say, 25 years when I came to Japan, I mean, there's something kind of interesting about going to a foreign country. I mean, as you mentioned, people often say to me, wow, you came to Japan and you started your own company. That's amazing. Like, how did you do that in your, because it's not your own country. And I think it's actually easier to sometimes to do your own thing, to start your own company if you go to another country, because there are opportunities that you have if you go somewhere different. And I mean, there are things that you don't have. So being in Japan, you don't have your family to support you. You don't have a lot of things that you have back at home. But if you go to a foreign country, it's actually kind of easier to go in the route of starting your own business and doing your own thing, because you're kind of limited in what you can do anyway, right? So for me, say I came out 25 years ago. I did a couple of years teaching. And then I went into translation for about 3 years because I love learning things. I wanted to learn Japanese. So I had a very cushy job, but I wanted to stop doing that. And so I moved to a company and I started working as a translator, even though I wasn't particularly good at Japanese at the time, but I learned it doing that. And then, so this is going back, 21 years or whatever. And I started doing a very new sport at the time. It was called kiteboarding, or in the States, it's also called kite surfing as well. I think it's quite big in Florida, right? And so I started that in about 1999. And it was very, very hard to buy the kiteboarding equipment because there were only about, I don't know, at the time, there's probably about 20 or 30 people in the whole country of Japan doing it. So I had to import all the stuff. So I was importing from Canada. I mean, there weren't even proper kiteboarding kites at the time. It was just pretty random stuff. It was like snow kiting kites from Canada and stuff. And it was that I was importing some stuff from Hawaii, which is the kind of the birthplace of the sport. And France. And so I was importing things and I thought, well, you know what, I'll just see if I can sell these things. So back in 1999, I made my first e-com website. I had to make it IE6 compatible or compliant. And it was just, I just kind of bumbled my way as I've been doing my entire life, just been kind of going into things. It wasn't a particular plan. I just needed to buy things. I was importing things. Other people said they wanted to get it, so I'd sell it to them. So I thought, well, I'll just make a website. And just things kind of snowballed from that. And so I started an e-com in kiteboarding. It was a niche. It was a niche of the niche. You couldn't get anything more niche. When I started, there were, a few dozen people. And then it grew and grew. I actually opened my own store about 2 years later, brick and mortar store. At the time, there were 3 kiteboarders in my town. Everybody said there's no way that could possibly work. I even to this day, I'm not even sure why I thought it would be a good idea. I was young. Opened a store, and then I had the first website, which was kiteboardingjapan.com, and I had kiteboarding.jp when the .jp domain came out later. And kind of the whole industry kind of started to grow, and I was right at the beginning, and that was kind of the beginning of everything. Nothing was ever planned. It was just something that I liked, something I needed to do, and then I just kind of went with it, I guess.
Let me clarify a few things. So you opened a brick and mortar retail store for kite boarding.
Yeah.
In Japan.
Yeah.
And you created a website in 1998, 1999 in Japan.
Yeah.
So like, the domain was, you mentioned it, it was in English. Are you just translating it here, or was it a Japanese?
No,
was the whole site
to,
like, in,
Oh, the whole site. No, the whole site was in Japanese. The site was in Japanese, but you have to have a domain in English. I mean, there are, you can actually have a domain in Japanese, but it didn't catch on. That was back in 1998, 99. Around that time, you could actually use Japanese for your domains, but no, it didn't catch on. And I mean, like, nobody talks about it now.
But that means that people were finding you mostly from your store or from your website.
From the website. So I had the first kiteboarding website, and so I was ranked number one on Google the whole time for a good 15 plus years. I was always number one above Wikipedia when that came out, just because it had just been there for so long, and I had a blog. I mean, yeah. It was thinking about it.
I find that fascinating. Like, to this day, like, approaching websites, that's a big thing. Someone that did it in 1999.
It's a long time ago.
Foreign language, really.
It was also that. Like, it was just the fact that, I mean, like, well, certainly in Japan, there wasn't any e-commerce kind of platforms to use. So I had a blog on the very old WordPress that I would link to the site itself. And the site wasn't an e-com site per se. You would email me your order. And then it slowly, when e-com kind of tools came out and payments came out, I kind of started to put that in. But I mean, back then, I mean, people in Japan, they weren't using credit cards. So it was generally COD. So people pay on delivery or bank transfer. I mean, it was very rudimentary, you know. That is an understatement, but there wasn't anything else. Yeah, it was kind of interesting. No, I haven't thought about that.
So what happens to that business?
So I had that business for quite a long time. I mean, I haven't done it for years. And so I had the store, the whole thing was going for about 15 years in total. I actually moved to another store as well, a bigger store. So I moved on from the kiteboarding a long, long time ago, but I kept the store just because I had it for so long, and it was ranked so well. I was still making sales to it, but it wasn't an intentional shift. I completely changed what I wanted to do. I kind of decided it wasn't the best thing. It was 2008, Lehman shock was the first time I realized that. I mean, the whole thing about when I actually started the shop, I thought, well, I'll do this for 10 years. I actually did it a little bit more than 10 years. And then the Lehman shock, 2008, I thought, this is time. It's you have to pivot. So I started to look at doing different things, and I kind of moved on from there. Although I kept the store going for a little bit longer.
So what was next? Is that where we hit Amazon?
No. So actually Amazon was actually before that. And this is something I only thought about when it came up in Clubhouse a couple of weeks ago. I didn't realize I was actually selling on Amazon way back in the day, because I had kiteboarding DVDs and like leashes. They called these retractable real leashes for board. So I had those on Amazon. I was selling those FBM. So that's probably, you know, I'm not even sure when, but that was probably back in 2000. I don't know, 6, 7, 8, maybe. So I was actually selling them, but I didn't even really think about Amazon. It was just there, and I'd make daily sales on it. And I was just shipping out, say, FBM. So after the kiteboarding, the main business, or the main thing I went into, was actually I went back into a company. So I'm in a town which is famous for the car industry. The town I'm in is the home of Suzuki, Honda, Yamaha, and then Toyota is the next town down. So it's a very car-based industry. And there was a company who made parts for these. It's called a tier one company. It's one of the main suppliers, global suppliers for these companies. So I went to work at the company in procurement. And so that's where I kind of really, really learned about. It's kind of, you know, the grass is always greener side of things. When you have your own business for a long time, you kind of, there's the stress of it, and you kind of think it'd be kind of nice to work in a company. And if you're in a company, you kind of think it'd be nice to do your own thing. I've actually flip-flopped a couple of times in my life. So I've actually seen both sides like a good two times. In the meantime there, I worked full-time as a programmer as well in a company. I did that just for like a year. And then decided I wanted to go back. So that was after Lehman Shock, actually. So I actually went back into the kiteboarding for a couple more years. And then I went on to procurement, and I worked in the automotive industry. And that's when I learned about production. So it was my job to travel around the world, mainly Europe, because I'm going to build a new factory in Europe. And so I had to learn to speak to all the suppliers. I had to audit suppliers. I had to audit factories. So I had to learn about metal working, plastics, molds, just everything that goes into these parts. And so I did that for about 4 years. And while I was doing that, towards the end, because I understood a lot about production, I decided, I had a previous experience of selling, both online and retail. I kind of put those two together, and I started developing my own products. And that's when I started on Amazon. So I did that for about a year before I left that company. And then I left and went full-time on Amazon back in, 2017, maybe, early 2017, or 16, one of those two. Well, that was a bit of a ramble, wasn't it?
I found that fascinating. You know what I like? I like to learn there is that, what skills do you think you picked up doing procurement, kite surfing, all these different things that you feel are helping you now in your Amazon business?
You know what? That's such a good question. The thing is, for me, I don't often speak to people about these things. That's why, just for me, just saying these things, it's kind of, I haven't really spoken about that very much, and I haven't even thought about it for so long. And about the skills, I didn't really think about it at the time, but recently I have kind of been thinking more about it. So there are loads of skills. Obviously, starting my own business was a skill. Learning how to cost things to make sure you are making money when you're selling. You know, you could sell a lot and not make any money if you're not careful. So there was that. There was running a business, having staff, selling online and offline. So selling online, you've got to learn how to sell, right? People coming to the store. I mean, I wasn't selling cheap things. I mean, the things I was selling cost, $3,000, $4,000. So you learn that. You learn business on the procurement side. And obviously, selling online as well, because I had the online component. Working in procurement, that was probably the best skill for being an Amazon private label seller, somebody who has a brand, just because it's something that people don't talk about very much. I mean, there's quite a lot about marketing, and that's something I'm very weak on. I appreciate it's one of my worst skills, online marketing. I think a lot of people come from marketing and they find a product and they sell it on Amazon, whereas I think a lot more about the product and how to make the product and how to make a product that's difficult to copy. I use multiple suppliers, multiple factories. So those are the things I definitely wouldn't have learned if I hadn't been traveling around factories and speaking to all these different types of manufacturers about materials. It's kind of, you don't really think about it at the time, but there's obviously lots of things that I had picked up, and that had all been merged into doing private label on Amazon, I guess.
So yeah, a little aside, just listening to you say that, have you come across any factories in Japan or any like manufacturers in Japan of goods that are now the manufacturer of your product?
No. So I have suppliers in Japan. There are some very specific Japanese industries that I'm using for my products. So I actually buy the materials from them. They're sent out to China and the products are made and they come back again. And I've got tie-ups with those companies. And so I actually sell the products to them and through their stores as well. But there are factories. So I kind of had I decided a few years ago that I wanted to have a project where I'd actually use all the amazing manufacturing in my town and actually have a product. This wouldn't be for Amazon. This would be like a big, project for the Japanese market. And because of obviously COVID, and it's really hit this area, because the car industry is not great at the moment, putting it mildly. So there's lots of factories here, really amazing factories as well. So I kind of had this product that I've kind of been wanting to make for many years, and I've finally started to move on that. So I'll be using local suppliers here, local mold manufacturers. I've just started making the first steps of making the first samples. This is my kind of big project. It's got nothing to do with Amazon, nothing at all. The products, if it does finally go through, may go on Amazon, but it's kind of my Dyson kind of project. There is a product that pretty much everyone in Japan would want to buy, but it doesn't currently exist in the form that I'm thinking of. So I want to do something here that uses local people. I mean, apart from the fact that obviously I've lived in this town for a long time, like the level here is very, very high in Japan. And I'd actually add that production in Japan is actually very, very cheap. So I would have to get quotes from global manufacturers, like, for example, mold companies. I'd get quotes from China, from Korea, from Europe, from Japan. Because if you work for these large companies, often it doesn't matter where the molds are made. So if we're making products in, we had lots of factories in Nissan for the company I worked for. Molds suck in China. Sorry, in America. You know, the American mold makers are very, very expensive, very, very difficult to work with. So normally molds were made in, for example, China and then shipped out. But often the Japanese mold makers will actually be cheaper, often be the cheapest. They are very, very reasonable. It's quite surprising. I think people think Japan is expensive, but Japanese wages on average are actually very, very low. So
the only thing I recall being expensive in China but in Japan was transportation.
Yes.
Everything else I found to be very affordable. But if you're visiting there, one thing, it's beautiful. I love sushi. There's a lot of other food. There's also, I don't know if it's still around, there's like probably the most authentic Irish pub I came across was in Japan. I think it was called like O'Malley's or something like that.
But you're American. You wouldn't know that. But okay, they have loads of Irish pubs, yeah, but... No. Japan's cheap, apart from transport. You're right. Transport was very, very expensive. But now if you go to Europe, like the bullet train, the Shinkansen in Japan is expensive. And I always thought it was expensive. If you go to Europe now, oh my God, it's even more expensive for travel. So, you know.
Let's take this to Amazon now. So we'll do we've never done a multiple choice on the show. So let's do a multiple choice. So best product sourcing tool for Amazon. You have A, Helium 10. B, Jungle Scout. C, Viral Launch. D, none of the above.
Okay. D. none of the above.
Although
you can't use Helium 10 anyway, because they don't currently support Japan and it's not on the roadmap. But yeah.
Sure. What back up your answer there. Like, what would be the best tool for somebody to use to do product research? To decide what to sell or if their product was a good fit for Amazon Japan.
Okay, so if you wanted to get really kind of granular and actually really try and find out the exact sales numbers, although exact is a very kind of, you know, it's not going to be exact either way using any tools, but you can use things like Jungle Scout. Jungle Scout now is in Japan. It now supports Japanese market. It's very new. I think it's only for about the last month or so. So you can actually look at your sales or sales numbers. You can do keyword research. You can use Jungle Scout for that. There is another tool as well called Seller Sprite. But I think the problem that most sellers have is that they kind of start off with the tools that they've been using, like Jungle Scout, or if you're using Helium 10 for the States or Europe, using Helium 10. I think the best tool to start with on your research is using Google. Google and YouTube, which obviously is Alphabet. So just to really, you kind of have to, first of all, don't look directly at the product you're selling and don't look so much at the products. Look at the category as a whole. So if you have products for home and garden or other kind of, look at a Japanese home, look at a Japanese garden. So don't start looking how many products you think your home and garden product would sell or your kitchen product would sell. First of all, look at what a Japanese kitchen looks like. And 9 times out of 10, it'll be really obvious whether it will sell or not. Just because there are some fundamental differences between the lifestyle of a Japanese person to the lifestyle of an American.
Can you give an example? I know you were just using that as a random thing, but do you have an example that really hammer the point home?
I think probably the easiest kind of example is home and garden, just because I don't actually have the stats now, but there is a good proportion of Japanese people that live in apartments that don't have a house. And if you do have a house, you're very unlikely to have a garden. And if you did have a garden, it wouldn't be what you would call a garden in certainly America. It would be absolutely tiny. So if you sold garden furniture, you'd be absolutely screwed. I mean, the market would be tiny. Although, I mean, because it's very niche, I mean, it's kind of hard to find garden furniture in Japan. So maybe you would sell, but the volume would be incredibly low. And houses, I mean, this is all pretty obvious stuff. Like if I was to say to you, are Japanese houses big or small? Like you can guess. I think the thing about Japan is that if you have a stereotype, they're actually often pretty accurate. That's the thing about stereotypes. They can actually, you can kind of nail it a bit when it comes to Japan. There's something I often mention that kind of sounds so stupid, but I'll mention it again. Japan is full of Japanese people, like at a rate that no other country has. It's like 97% are native Japanese. So people are very similar in their lifestyles, and the houses they live in are very similar houses. The salaries are very similar. So if your product is targeting large kitchens or like a decent amount of counter space, you aren't going to sell anything on Amazon Japan. If you're targeting something that would fit in a small kitchen, you've pretty much nailed 100% of the market here. Or things like storage units. I mean, this is something that people often bring up, but it's totally true. I mean, if you have a small house, you have to be efficient. Look at China. I mean, you can also look at things like Korea as well. I mean, there are products that are popular in both the markets because they're kind of similar in many ways.
So something like a Swiss Army knife of this. So I'm thinking space saver. So if it's a standalone pepper shaker, a standalone salt shaker, that may not do as good as a combo that's just one. It's going to take up less tabletop space. Is that what I'm hearing?
You want to call? Yeah, exactly. And then taking that further, if you could have it so that you could mount it on a wall or get it off the tabletop, that'll be even better. But then you have to remember that Japanese people rent generally; they don't buy, which means you don't want something that screws into a wall because you can't. You're not allowed to do that. So there's lots of these little things like wall mounting TVs. Don't do very well in Japan because people don't tend to wall mount things because they don't want to put things into their walls. There's lots of small things that you could pick up if you just start looking. That's what this whole thing is coming back to. Just understand what, like travel. Let's go to travel for a second, okay? That's not something you'd get from looking at a YouTube video maybe, but if you were just to kind of Google a little bit about travel in Japan and the fact that culturally, for example, the Japanese people don't have holidays, right? There are only three times of year Japanese people get any time off. There's Golden Week, which is in May. There's Obon, which is in August. And then there's the New Year holiday. It's not Christmas. Christmas is a work day in Japan. It's the New Year holiday. There's only three times. But people have very, very few days off, which means that, and it's in the same, everybody has a holiday at exactly the same time, which means that flights and travel becomes ridiculously expensive on those dates. You can't just take 2 weeks off. Never happens. You cannot work for a Japanese company and go and take 2 weeks off outside the main period and go on holiday. That would just never, ever happen. Literally, the number of people who could do that is incredibly low, which means that a lot of travel goods won't really work for Japan because if people do go on holiday, it's only for a couple of days anyway. They'll fly to Hawaii for like 2 or 3 days over New Year if they got a lot of money, right? So there's whole industries and things you have to understand that will work and won't work. And they're more overarching culturally. So just Google about Japan. If you're in travel, Google about Japanese travel, when people travel, when people have holidays to travel. And I think you'll understand just from that, my product will work or won't work, you know? If it's a product that's good for traveling in Japan, that's different, you know?
What would you say like is the biggest hangout for people in Japan? Like by that, I mean, like Clubhouse is picking up now, but I don't notice a lot of Japanese people in Clubhouse. There's Facebook, everything. Is there a social media type that is most popular in Japan?
Okay. Carlos, it's very interesting you mentioned Clubhouse. Okay, so I actually started on Clubhouse at the beginning of January, I think, or mid-January. I mean, I've been on there forever, right? It's been at least a month. And I was, and like the main reason for me starting on there was actually to find sellers in Japan, not foreigners, but Japanese people who are in, it didn't actually have to be online. It could be off. I just wanted to speak to people in business in Japan. This is kind of hard for me to do it where I am here, right? And I couldn't find anybody. There was absolutely nothing. And about a week ago, it went absolutely berserk. Like everybody in Japan is on Clubhouse now. It's on TV. Even my kids are talking about it. It's like, it's bizarre. For me, in my, what's it called, hallway, it's all Japanese rooms. There's loads of it now. So it's huge now. I've got to tell you, it's huge, especially with like the VCs from Tokyo. They love talking about being a VC in Tokyo. It kind of annoys the shit out of me, but anyway. So they have that. And then, so Facebook is kind of a no-no, like not a no-no, but Facebook is not used very much in Japan. It never took hold. It's a very American thing, and Japanese people don't really do that. They used to have a different, oh God, what's the name? There was a rival site that was for Japanese people, and it was basically the Japanese version of Facebook. And it's early in the morning here, and I'm totally blanking about the name of it, but that's almost died as well now. So kind of coming back to the Amazon thing, if you do Messenger, any Messenger bots, that won't work for Japan because essentially Facebook isn't used very much. So Messenger isn't used very much. So you can kind of throw your whole Messenger bot flow out. That won't really work. Actually, Facebook now is kind of being used for business more. It's taking over kind of the LinkedIn kind of role in Japan. So people are using it for business and not for their own personals. So for a long time, I said there was another one, but now people mainly communicate and talk online. There's an app called Line. It's a native Japanese. I think it's native Japanese, and it's popular in Korea and Japan. I think it is native in Japan. So everybody has Line. So if you go out and meet somebody, you get their Line details, and everything goes through Line. For business, we use Line as our main tool for reaching out to customers. It's used for everything. It's like the Chinese version of WeChat. You know, WeChat, it's for communicating, it's for calling, it's for paying, it's for everything, right? Line is basically putting things in that WeChat has. It's becoming this overarching app.
And Line as in like a straight line or Line it's, as yeah, in like, lemons and limes?
It's Line, L-I-N-E. It's Line. So that's what everybody uses. So it has a timeline as well, which we've actually just started using for business. We hadn't actually used the timeline for our business. We started doing that, and it's working really, really well. So yeah, you've got to be online. Facebook is not where it's at all. You can run Facebook ads. We run ads mainly on Instagram. So Instagram's big. Instagram and Line are probably the two places you want to be if you're talking about kind of on the business side.
What advice would you give? Let me ask you this, and then I want you to, if you can, speak a little bit about your Facebook group. What advice would you give somebody who's currently selling in the United States, Amazon.com, and they really kind of maxed out what they can do in the U.S.? They're at a good level where they should be thinking of selling outside of the U.S. and they're considering Japan. What would be some advice that you would give them?
I think the very first thing, come back to this kind of this main discussion, just have a look to see if your products would sell. Maybe they're selling 100 or 200 a day in America, but it might sell zero a day in Japan if it just doesn't fit the country. It doesn't fit the culture. It just doesn't fit what people would buy. On the flip side, there is a chance you could sell infinitely more here because it might fit the Japanese market a lot better. And that's something I should probably quickly mention here. The Japanese market, it's smaller than the American market. It's a third of the population. But if you get the right product in the right category, your potential market could be infinitely larger. You know, there are going to be a lot more Japanese people of a certain, I mean, I sometimes bring that up, and it sounds stupid, like a certain shoe size, for example, because Japanese people tend to be the same or have the same kind of kitchens. So if you've got something that will fit a type of kitchen in Japan, because most people have that same type of kitchen, the potential market is a lot bigger, right? So first of all, look into that. That is the first thing you have to do. Don't assume that because your product sells very well in America, it'll sell very well in Japan. It could sell awful. It could sell even better. So come back, look at Google, look at YouTube. Just do some very broad searches, first of all. So that's probably the most important thing I think you should do if you're going to look to go into Japan. And then beyond that, all the steps that you would do, I don't know, do you want to kind of go into like the things that you should be aware of or not aware of, or the steps to start in Japan?
Anything like tax implications, importing, like is there anything out of the ordinary that you've noticed?
Well,
you may not be prepared for?
Yeah, okay. So yes, there is. So first of all, when it comes to tax, obviously, probably not a good idea for me to speak about it, but you don't have to worry about the consumption tax too much unless your sales are over 10 million Japanese yen, which is about £100,000, $100,000 a year. Under that, you don't have to worry so much about consumption tax. There is a problem with importing now in Japan. I've got to bring this up. So this happened, it started happening from about last summer. The customs office is starting to really overstep what I think they're permitted to do in, I'm not even, basically clamping down on tax. But the way they were doing it is, so as I just mentioned, if your sales are under $100,000, you don't have to pay consumption tax in Japan, even if you're a Japanese business, right? But the tax office were asking foreign sellers, and they were specifically targeting Amazon sellers. So they would see if your product is selling on Amazon, right? Because they could see if you were selling it to a fulfillment center in Amazon or if it had FNSKU labels on it. And they were asking, and still are, asking to see the page that the products are being sold on Amazon. And then they were basically calculating what they thought the import tax should be based on that, not on the cost of the goods, which is what it has always traditionally been, but on what they think it should be. So they were kind of almost randomly charging 30 to 40% of the retail price on Amazon. So this is something you've got to be aware of. So traditionally, and in fact, Amazon is still wrong on their website. They've got information about IOR, which is importer of record, which has always been necessary for Japan. And I used to run an IOR company, so I know a lot about this. It was a requirement. Amazon is still saying it in the IOR. The customs office are no longer permitting an importer of record. They actually want somebody to be, they want you to be the importer directly. So it's kind of like a proxy importer. It's called an ACP, which is where the importer, where you are still the importer, but they basically work on your behalf with the customs office. So if a customs office has a problem, they ask you ask the ACP for any further information, and the ACP will come back to you. This is probably getting a bit too in the weeds, but just make sure you speak to somebody who understands about import in Japan. Just make sure your freight forwarder really understands the situation. There are loads of ways you can do this now. You can get around the problems, but just don't blindly send a product into FBA without speaking to somebody, because you may get into trouble. The goods may be sent back, or you may end up with a incredibly hefty tax bill.
So those are great tips. So everybody definitely should do their due diligence anytime they're going to sell in any country. Japan's no different. You have a Facebook group. I want to be respectful of your time too. You have a Facebook group, and you share everything you know about Japan and selling in Japan there, not just Amazon. We briefly spoke about Rakuten, so I'm sure people could ask Rakuten questions. We might be getting on a joint podcast coming up and like geeking out about selling Rakuten in Japan soon. Your Facebook group, what's the name of it? How can people find it? How can people get a hold of you and ask any questions? Like at the end here, we really did get into the weeds with IOR and all of these other acronyms that someone just thinking to sell in Japan may not know, shouldn't be intimidated by, because they can easily get the answer from you.
Okay, so the group is Amazon Japan PL. So it obviously stands for private label. I started that many, many years ago. I haven't been as active as I'd like to be, But if anybody ever has a question, they ask it there. I will always answer the questions on there to the best of my knowledge. So it's a private group, so just kind of request to go in. I do sometimes write some slightly longer form pieces about topics that are important. So this whole thing about IOR, there was a video, I did a joint video with somebody else who has another Amazon group in Japan. We did a video where I kind of explained the whole import situation. In fact, if you actually just Google my name, Nick Katz and Amazon, or Nick Katz Amazon Japan or something like that, those kind of videos will come up. But yeah, always try and hit me up in the group, Amazon Japan PL. I can certainly help out there.
Excellent. I believe I'm in the group. If not, I'm going to jump in. But either way, I'm going to link to it in the show notes of the show. Before letting you get on with your day, you're just starting. Mine's starting to come to a close. I actually have to get on a Clubhouse. I didn't even know you could invite people. Like, something just showed up on my calendar that there's a podcast pitch that I'm in.
Of course you can invite people.
No, but I didn't know you could pop it on a calendar. I don't know. We'll figure it out.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah, I didn't know. It just showed up on my calendar. But
it could be a new feature. I mean, there was an update, I think, yesterday or 2 days ago. So it's possible it's an update from that. Or change.
Let's see. I'm going to get into that. But before letting you get away and on with your day, something I ask everyone that's on the show, what is your favorite book and why?
Ah, the books. Okay. So I should probably say I'm not a huge reader. I love learning and I'm constantly reading every day, learning new things, but I'm not a very good book reader. And I've never really read any business books, all the kind of usual famous business. And I know that you really like your business books and mindset books. And that's something that I've never really been into. So on that note, because I've always am fascinating in learning and how people learn, one book is kind of difficult, but a book that I found very impactful for me in the last couple of years, I read it about 2 years ago, was Moonwalking with Einstein, which is a very famous book. I mean, about is it by Fuhr? I think it's his name. And it's kind of about the power of the human brain. He was a journalist who decided to write about these memory champions. And then he actually ended up being a memory champion himself. And it kind of, the thing I liked about the whole concept was that anybody can learn and remember things if you just take your time and use the brain like a muscle and exercise it. And actually, I think the reason why the book for me was so impactful was because there was a documentary I saw years ago when I was flying back to the UK, I don't know how many years ago, and the documentary was called Brain Man. And that documentary just blew my mind. Have you ever seen the documentary?
I have not.
Oh my God, Brain Man, it's amazing. Okay, so it was a guy who had an epileptic fit when he was about 4 years old. And it was about the fact that it changed his brain in a way that he was able to... he saw the world in a different way. He saw the world in numbers and he was able to remember everything. And in this documentary, he reads pi for about 6 hours. He goes through, you know, hundreds of thousands or not thousands and thousands of digits. And it was just amazing to see the power of the human mind. In the documentary, he went to meet the guy who was on, what was the Tom Cruise movie about the guy with the amazing memory? Totally blanking now.
Rain Man.
He went to meet the guy and they hugged. It was an amazing movie. But then I read Moonwalking with Einstein and the guy basically debunks the person in this documentary. And the guy in the documentary, he was a fake, but he did remember pi. He could read it for 6 hours, but not because he had like his brain was rewired. It was just because he just learned to do it. And it's quite amazing. I recommend everybody watch the documentary Brain Man and then read Moonwalking with Einstein and you'll have the most amazing concept of what the mind can do.
I love it. Yeah, that is amazing. I've not heard, ever heard of that book, but that's that has to be
really. We were looking with Einstein. Oh my God! It's really
not, and that has to be the most thorough why to read the book that has been on the show today, which I love. A lot of people are just like, "You should read this." Yeah, it's really good. And I get the books. Like, I've made this thing like whoever recommends a book on my show and I've not read it, immediately after this, I'm going to look for it on Amazon, or I'm going to go get the book and I'm going to read it. So I have not heard of this book. I'm sure I'll see the author next to it when I'm searching for it, but I'm going to grab this book as soon as we wrap this up.
Yeah.
Watch
the documentary first, though. Watch Brain Man. It's a brilliant documentary anyway, but you've got to watch it before you read the book, and then it will make a lot more sense.
I'll start checking it out on the way to this clubhouse meeting. Nick, thank you. Huge, huge, huge thank you for taking the time before your day gets going to jump on the show.
Thank you.
Super happy you were on the show. Actually, I'm looking forward to and brainstorming a future show with you about Rakuten. So have an amazing day.
Okay. Thanks very much, Carlos. Thank you. Thanks for having me on.